Welcome to the Alchemist Wisdom Corner with your host, Nicola Hurst. Today is the launch of a new show that hopes to inspire, educate, and empower. I could think of no better way to launch this show than to invite as a guest one of the most powerful voices on the internet and beyond. He is known as the Oprah of the internet, with interviews that include some of the greatest scholars and minds of our time, people like Robert Kiyosaki, Stedman Graham, Professor Kaba Kamene, just to name a few. He is the founder of the Shock Metaphysics Comedic Wisdom School, the author of Digitonomics, and numerous other works. His credentials are so numerous, we don't have time to list them all. And I am honored to call him friend and brother. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the metaphysical Morpheus, Mr. Philippe Shock Matthews. Welcome to the show, my dear brother. What an honor to do this interview with you.
Hotel to my sister Nicola Hurst. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. You were saying all those things. I was like, who just getting ready to come on? I was about to sit down and listen to the show myself.
The most extraordinary mind I know.
I know some people will say, well, you don't know nobody then. If you're talking about that crazy man right there, you don't know nothing.
I just think you're an extraordinary person. The things that you're doing right now to build a platform for not only today, but for future generations to come is one of the most amazing things. And I've just been a fan since I found you in 2015.
Wow. Thank you for that. Wow. That's a long time. Thank you for that. It's been a crazy ride. It's been a crazy journey, but it's all well worth it.
Yes. Are you, like I am, trying to uplift our people, raise the vibration of the planet by doing the very best that we can to serve in ways of educating and inspiring. And you've been bringing phenomenal information to us all this time. You've done an amazing job of just building such an extraordinary platform with some of the most scholarly minds of our time. What motivated you to build this type of platform, and how did you get started?
Well, as I've said on my show many times, this was about self-help for me. Mm-hmm. I had to figure out, I knew something was wrong with me. Later in my years, I realized there was nothing wrong with me. Something had happened to me, but I didn't know that back then. So yes. I said, well, let me try to find people that I can talk to because I can't afford counseling. So let me see if I can learn how to interview people, because I'm reading all these self-help books, but let me see if I can contact the authors and have a conversation with them and ask them some deeper questions on based upon their work. So that, you know, started back in 86. And so that was it's been a long time that I've been asking questions. And so over the years, I got very good at not only helping myself, but helping others through the veil of being able to either read my interviews, watch my interviews, or listen to my interviews on a radio show, and just like this one. And it's been an absolute blessing. And, you know, I've learned things that have literally changed my life, but also has changed the lives of so many others.
That is amazing. I think it's one of the most innovative things to think about gathering your help in that way. I think that's a very innovative way to think about getting help, because I don't think most people would think along the line of finding people to interview in order to heal.
Yeah, yeah. And it was weird because I didn't think of it like that at the time, but I just remember there were books, authors, and experts that I had admired, I had read, it had changed me and caused me to become a deeper thinker. And then I said, you know, maybe I can write an interview, because, you know, I was very archaic back in the day. I literally used to handwrite, you know, transcribe the interview, record it on a tape recorder, transcribe it on a piece of paper. And then write about it in a Q&A, and then I would go out and try to find newspapers and magazines that would run the article.
Wow.
So this was long before the internet. You know, I didn't start doing the internet thing till 98. Mm-hmm. The internet on board in 94. So prior to that, I had those old 1970s, you know, project tape recorders, you know, that you just sit down and push, you know, you have to hold the play button and the record button at the same time and push down, you know. And I would record these people, and then I got a little sophisticated and got one of those things that I could hook up to the phone, and then started recording people on a cassette tape, by the way, just so that you know how far back this goes. So some of the people might hear, say, "What's that? A cassette tape? What is that?" And I remember talking, you know, to like a motivational speaker, Les Brown,
right?
And it was on a cassette recorder, and I would listen to the tape. I would play it back and over again, rewind, fast forward, rewind, play, fast forward. And I would transcribe all of the, you know, an hour long, 2 hour long conversation by hand.
Wow, that's dedication.
That's how dedicated I was, because I knew, I said, oh my God, what he or she, whoever it was that I was interviewing at the time, I said, this is life-changing. And so, and at least it was for me. And so I just figured, if it's life-changing for me coming from where I come from,
mm-hmm.
then I am certain that it would be life-changing for someone else.
Right.
And over the years, I just learned how to take that knowledge and information and be able to share it with the world, but then learn how to monetize it so that not only would I be able to support myself and sustain life, but I would be able to show others a blueprint or an architect of how to do the same thing for theirs, depending upon where they're at and who they're at and what it is that they wanted to do and how they wanted to manifest in the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the dedication that it took for you to do what you were doing way back then. Do you mind sharing some of your background as to why you felt so dedicated to succeed?
Yeah, I haven't gone back there in a while because it's a painful place to go back to, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
I'll basically start with the loss of my parents, and particularly my mother dying. I was 14 years old, and I was just thinking about this the other day, and it was a cold, I'm from Chicago, so it was a cold February night, and I was in the bathroom, and I was washing up in a face bowl, doing what they call the poor man's wash up, showers were broken, and I heard my sister screaming, and I came out, and it was my mom, and she was taking her last breath, and I picked her up, and I put her in the bed, and I saw her literally take her last breath, and that was when I knew my life at that point had ended. And that if I had have lived, my life would never be the same again. And my parents had divorced when I was 6 years old, so I hadn't had really much contact off and on with my father. He was kind of in and out of my life. He came back into my life and my older sister's life at that time and took us to his basement apartment on the south side of Chicago. I think it was 45th and Lake Park. Wow, I can't believe I remember that. Which is nothing but condos now. You can't even, you would think I come from, you know, a million-dollar lifestyle, because everything that used to be there now is worth $1 million. They tore it down and gentrified it.
Right.
But it was poverty-stricken, let me tell you what. So I was on welfare the whole nine, okay? So it was not what it is today, fam.
Yeah.
And so it was just me and my pops, and he was very abusive. He was an alcoholic, and you know, I have told the story that, you know, he hit my sister in the head with a hammer and gave her, you know, like, you know, 9 stitches, and when she was 16 or 19 or something like that, and so I just remember that story being told to me by my mom and the family. So they never got along, and she never forgave him, and so that just kind of crippled her in her life. And then, you know, so here I am now back with the father that I didn't know and didn't necessarily want to, because I really never liked my dad. I just, you know, I never trusted him. He was violent. He was unpredictable. So I really couldn't stand him. 2 months later, he drops dead right in front of me.
Wow.
So Yeah, so you asked the doggone question. That's what. You tell me what you asked for, doggone. Well, Philippe, tell me a little bit about your past.
It takes extraordinary pain sometimes to make an extraordinary man, and it looks like that's where you get that dedication from.
No doubt. I had to hustle my way, and I had to figure out. So here's the real crux of it. The crux of why I do what I do is because of three promises I made to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I would never do drugs.
Right.
Or sell drugs. Number two is I would not join a gang or get involved in gang activity. And three, I would make something of myself.
Mm-hmm.
If I had not kept those three promises, I would have been a drug dealer, drug user, and a gang member. I would have been in the life because at 14 with no parents, you look for a family that would have been, and coming from the south side of Chicago, that would have been my family. So it's only because of those three promises I made to her, and so she has kept me alive in her death all these years, now going on 53 years. So
wow.
I had to figure out how to get out because that didn't mean that because I made these three promises that, every time I'm like, okay, I got to make something of myself. Okay, so I can't rob people. I can't steal people. I can't abuse women. I can't drink. So all of these things I had to look at because the part of the, even though I wasn't doing the drugs, I said, well, I can't do these other things either because I have, my mom got to be proud of me and I got to make her proud of me. So I had to, it forced my brain, I didn't know this then, this is later in years. It forced my brain, my prefrontal cortex, to find an answer, to find a way.
Mm-hmm.
So my way was through reading and writing and articulating and learning how to ask questions, which in turn I was really learning how to ask for help.
Wow. This is amazing.
I ain't never shared that on anybody's show before. This girl, you good. You got that Oprah in you. That's when you know you're old. You say, girl, you got that Oprah in you. Yes, you do. Uh-huh, she so does.
I have because a lot of dedication to doing what you to have done what you did to build the platform that you have built and that you're still doing. And that, that kind of drive comes from someplace. You don't just wake up with that. That comes from something.
That's a good point. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And everybody has, particularly if you are melanated in America, you have that story. You have a drive. You have something that will propel you and push you.
Right.
Yeah. What I love about the brain is the brain will figure it out. It will find a way. But sometimes it's like forging steel. Sometimes you have to be put in a situation. It's called the Pygmalion effect, where you're put in a position where you have to go up, because if you don't, you're going to go down or be dead.
Right. It puts you in the position to really think too. I don't have any children, but, people that want to make life better for them, for their children, and then you see them have better circumstances and they sometimes have less drive, and you wonder, if you're doing them a favor by giving them too much. But you don't want somebody to deal with the type of pain that you had to come from. But that pain really did drive you to do some amazing, extraordinary things. And it paid off in dividends for the things that are flourishing out of you at this point.
Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. Yeah, I learned this from Oprah and learning how to turn pain into a passion. How to turn struggle into a positive sequence.
Wow.
I have had so many role models, people that I have met, people that I will never meet, whether they're alive or deceased, people that just are in the virtual space, the books that I have read over the years, all have led me to this place that I'm currently in. And honestly, I can say it's the best place I've ever been in my entire life. because I live in a constant state of knowledge and wisdom. And I'm around people like yourself, the most brilliant thinkers and minds literally on earth today. And that's just something that is, you know, it's mind-boggling because I only made it to the sixth grade because that's another backstory of the backstory that I had to drop out of school to take care of my mom because she was given 3 months to live.
Wow.
And so that was, you know, obviously prior, you know, before her death. And so I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to be functional right now. I'm supposed to be that dude that is on the streets, in the prison, homeless, crime, you know, struck, or dead.
Right. Right. This is extraordinary, Philippe. The more I hear your story, the more proud I am for what you have accomplished and the things that you have been able to not only do for yourself, because you say this is for your own healing, but to share with the world the type of information that you are sharing. And it leads me to think about some of the professionals that you've had on your show. The professional scholars that have graced your platform and given us information to help us see who we were before, as Professor Kyle Akamine would say, before the great interruption of slavery. Can you walk us through some of the insight of what you've learned, like from the earliest beginnings of our existence on this planet, coming up to the place that we are now? Because we didn't start with the kind of disruptions that we're dealing with now with racism and things. We had things going for us long before we had to deal with the kind of pain that we're dealing with today with some of the things that we're seeing. Do you have any insight on some of the things that your scholars have given us from, like, the beginning that you like?
Ooh, I was like, how long you got? you know, one of the
what?
I know, right? I know. You know, part of this is also going through my process of awakening, and we call it being woke. And it happened late for me in my years. Some people have it in their teens and 20s and early 30s. And, I mean, it didn't happen for me till my 40s, late 40s.
Yeah.
And so, but everything in my life came up to a point where I kept hitting a brick wall, meaning that I kept saying, well, maybe if I do a little bit more, maybe if I can just be better, maybe if I can get a better skill set, I can do better and be better, and realizing that I was bumping up against this thing called racial battle fatigue. I had no idea that the successes or lack of successes and how hard it was to become successful was not based on my talent or skills or gift, but it was based on this invisible force called white supremacy.
Right.
And so that caused me, so it caused me to go through a cascade of aha moments in going to that research. Because, mind you, by now, I pretty much know how to get into some research. I know how to get some books. I know how to go online. I know how to start asking questions. I know what questions to look for. And each answer led me to another question, which led me to another answer, and led me to another expert. And so it started with, oddly enough, a psychologist by the name of Brian King, a white guy, who was not authored. He was doing a seminar on habits and stress and how habits and stress, how stress can form habits. And he introduced me to a part of the brain called the VMPFC, the ventral medial prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
And he said that part of the brain, when it has a certain amount of stress, it's like a circuit breaker, it completely shuts down and ceases to function. And all of a sudden, you don't know what to do. You can't think straight. You can't make optimal decisions for yourself. You start making all the wrong decisions. You procrastinate. You do a myriad of things that are contraindicated to your success. And I said, oh, shit, that's me. Mm-hmm. I'm going through this right now. Wait a minute now. You all sit all up in my business. What you doing, Dr. Mr. King?
Probably so, last month.
Yeah, you know, so I dug in. I said, okay, let me learn everything I can about the VMPS, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. How does it work? Where is it located in the brain?
Right.
That research then led me to Dr. Luann Bergendijk, where I learned about epigenetics.
Okay.
And I learned how epigenetics pre-programs our DNA to manifest a certain reality or not manifest a certain reality before our arrival is even thought about, 3 generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my God, are you kidding me? I said, wait a minute. Well, I'm an African-American. I'm a brother, so I know where we come from. So, of course, that did what? That caused me to go deep into, well, where did we come from? Because our story is mostly about roots and Black History Month in February. And so most of us just have that framework, thinking that that's where we come from, not knowing that, one, we're the original people. Two, mm-hmm. we have created and built all civilization. Three, being first, not only were we first, but we were first and on this planet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years prior to the arrival of any what we call a European.
Right.
So all of this research just began to flood my neocortex, flood my brain,
mm-hmm.
and caused me to go out and find every living expert, and some deceased, on how powerful and how magnificent our African human family really is. And so that caused me to study axiology, which is the study of human values and how the environment shapes the culture, the individual, based upon climate change, based upon what they have available and the people that are around them. It caused me to go and look and find out about the northern and southern cradle dynamic from the late Dr. Sheikh Abdul Dejope,
mm-hmm.
and how understanding Bergman's law, Glozier's law, and Allen's law, and how the environment changes our phenotype over time. And if we're exposed to an ice age where there's no sun and the ice comes from the bottom up, not from the top down, and you're dealing with 100 degree, 200 below zero temperatures, and what does that do to you epigenetically, axiologically, environmentally, psychologically, emotionally, when you are not just in that climate, but when you procreate in that climate, and then you have generations of people from that climate, and that becomes your normal way of living, where every day somebody, the environment, which for some people might say God, is trying to kill you.
Right.
Just imagine waking up every day, and what you look up in the sky, and the heavens, and all around you, everything is trying to kill you. Because if
right.
you go out in that cold, and you don't have the what you need to stay warm and to stay alive, you will die. Your family will die. Your children will die. So
mm-hmm.
it causes you to really develop a psychosis
mm-hmm.
Based on the environment that you're in, that you have to control all the resources, because if you don't, you will die. And so we now know that that is the story of the European.
Right.
That's where they come from, and that's why they are the way they are, because they were in an environment that they only had 3 months out of a year to plant crops, grow them, and eat. If they screwed up any part of that process within that three-month period of time, that tribe, that family would die off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was no Dr. Phil. There was no Oprah back then and there. You know, there was nobody to talk them through, here's how you treat a woman. Here's how you treat your children. Here's how you treat your neighbor. It was all about me, 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 take, screw everything else. I've got to have it. I've got to own it. I've got to control it. And that's kind of where the supremacy mindset came from. So now let's take that from an evolutionary perspective and bring it all. Now, mind you, we are sitting up, you know, in the motherland in Africa,
mm-hmm.
falling from the tree because we're the closest to the equator. So that's why we have dark skin. That's why we are melanated people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything comes from the black. So that goes into the technology of melanin and carbon, and everything comes from the black. But, you know, we had populated the entire planet. So here's the crazy rub is that Europeans are just depigmented Africans based upon being captured or lost in the Ice Age. So their survival skills come from us, but their survival skills are on steroids because they had to fight the ice.
Yes.
And as a result of that, you're looking at a super predator.
Wow.
Versus us, we don't, so they had to fight, and still are, fight against their extinction. Because if they don't do these things that are necessary for their survival, that population that got caught in the ice will grow and go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that creates an epigenetic tag of I got to get mine, screw everybody else. In fact, I got to take it from you because there's not enough in the world. So I've got to set up a whole system so that I can take it and own it. And I'm not going to ask you for it. I'm just going to take it
and
then sell it back to you and make you a slave to it.
Right.
Mind you, the Africans, we don't have that epigenetic tag because the environment is giving us everything. So guess what? We never had to, from a survival perspective, learn how to create weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to create guns. We had spears and knives and swords for hunting, for fighting amongst other tribes, but nothing that would annihilate humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our epigenetic code. It's not our thing. So imagine coming out of the ice and imagine that first meeting.
Right.
So here you have a civilized culture and population that's built the pyramids, has mastered architecture, has mastered science, has mastered culinary, has mastered every aspect of living. They're coming out of the ice. They're coming out of the cage.
Mm.
Us being who we are, loving people, giving people, sharing people, teach them how to be civilized.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, they end up doing exactly what they do and what they are, and that is take it from. Let's see if we can go and conquer rather than equally trade with this group. Let's see if we can conquer them because there's more of them than us, and there's only a finite group of us, and if we don't do this, we will become extinct because they have the epigenetics of extinction. We don't have that that DNA tag.
Right.
So here we are in America, 1492. Now, mind you, the Europeans had been coming here quite some time prior to the 1492, surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Basically getting a lay of the land and seeing how they can conquer the people, but coming smiling, hey, let's trade, let's talk, hey, how you doing, and with the people until they got enough information to say, let's take over this country. Let's just take it.
Mm-hmm.
So here they are with this mentality, this ice mentality. Let's take it. Let's turn them into slaves. If they can't be enslaved, kill them. And we have to make this, you know, so white, well, first of all, there was no such thing as white. You were just European.
Right.
So wherever you were, whatever part of that Europe, you know, location you were from, you come here and you, quote unquote, settle the land. And of course, there's going to be a little bit of resistance, you think.
Mm-hmm.
If someone comes to your home and says, the car that's in your garage, the house that you live in, the bed that you sleep is all mine now. Now, wait a minute. I've been here before you, and you're telling me I can't live in my own house. I can't, I can't ride my own horse. I can't,
mm-hmm.
What are you saying? And yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Well, no. Okay, well, then I have to kill you. Because you're the male and you're supposed to take care of the family and support the family and protect the family. So I got to kill all of the males. And then I've got to make all the women subordinate to me because I'm superior and I have to take over this land. And so that's the story of the Native Americans, right?
Right.
Well, over time, because this European beast, if you will, not only cannot get along in a cohabitant manner with pigmented people, but they can't get along with each other. Because remember, in the ice, they had to fight and kill each other for food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where cannibalism came from. They were the first to have to eat their young and elderly, because if the crops did not manifest itself, because that was a trial and error situation, they had to eat something, and it was usually each other. And so they looked at the young, they looked at the elder. It becomes a personality, and what becomes then a personality then becomes a culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we now look at this situation and in the Americas here and say, okay, well, there's a rebellion here because the indentured servants and slaves, who at that time was both black, African and European.
Mm-hmm.
There was no such thing as race. There was no such thing as white or black. That was a new designation, a divide and conquer strategy that they put in place after Bacon's Rebellion, because the rich, the 1%, the poor people got together, marched, and started stealing back the wealth and looting the wealth of these wealthy homes and plantation and tobacco plantation owners.
Mm-hmm.
The king in England almost. This thing almost didn't happen. They said, look, if you can't correct this, we're not giving you any more support. You just got to come back home. We can't take this land.
Right.
And they said, wait a minute, we've got a divide and conquer strategy that we're going to put in place. And this is where those anti-miscegenation laws come into play that I talk about on my show all the time with Dr. Jacqueline Vallalora, who introduced me to this, these laws, 1664 to 1681. I'm not going to get into all of them, but there were three major laws that came out that put us in the situation that we are still into and fighting against today. And that was, one, a person of African descent could no longer vote or run for office.
Mm-hmm.
A person of African descent could no longer own guns or gunpowder. And number three, the most diabolical, a person of African descent could not sue or take any legal action against this new, never before written in history, designation to humanity called a white person. White people were literally invented as a matter of privilege and law to have privileges over anything African that was not white. So white had a specific purpose for to unite not just the white elite, but the poor whites and the poor white laborers that can now identify as white and have a benefit and a privilege that is better than being an African.
We wonder why black people can never quite catch up.
Exactly. So this is where that you know, they say that 500 years. Now this is, you know, hundreds of years before slavery. It took another 100 years to create race, right? Because all of this stuff we assume always has been, and it hasn't. But it's from this diabolical beast that was tortured for thousands of years in the ice that their mind became warped to the point where they literally today, in a sense, eat their young. So they turn on each other, and they turn on us.
Mm-hmm.
And so when dealing with something like that, you know, and of course your original question was, well, Philippe, tell us a little bit about our ancient history. Of course, now I went into this whole damn, you know.
Actually, everything I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear a timeline, and you painted that picture perfectly. I think what I'm more struck by is the fact that you could remember so much of this information. And spot it off and articulated that strategically across the timeline like that. I would probably be stuck with that much information I had to mash in my mind. That's amazing.
It really is amazing to see. And, you know, when I see a white person, a quote unquote, somebody who identifies as white, it is an identification. Now, they think in their mind, biologically, they're white. There's no such thing as biological white or biological black. It's a racial construct that was designed as a matter of law for whites to have certain privileges. Matter of fact, to be a naturalized citizen in the United States, you had to be white. And that mm-hmm. didn't come off the books until 1952.
Right.
right? So you can imagine the disparate of that, that anything non-white had to go through, particularly the African American, which was then the Negro or the color.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to create, because of the natural cognitive dissonance of the brain, which is basically two thoughts competing, two opposing thoughts competing with one another, it's like, wait a minute, this is supposed to be a human being, and I'm not supposed to treat a human being this way. But if I don't treat him this way, I won't eat, I won't survive, I won't be white, I won't have privilege. And so the mind, you know, the brain starts to fluctuate back and forth, and that happened after those anti-miscegenation laws came out. And so they realized, okay, we have to create race. We have to find a biological, even if we have to make it up, which they did, we have to make up a biological aspect of race so that we can justify the dehumanization, the slavery, and what we do to these things called Negroes.
It is a very brutal response to what they came out of. And I'm thinking, because I heard one time on one of your shows, Dr. Nzinga, I believe it was, that said that what we are going through as African Americans or blacks in this country at this time is more like our Ice Age.
Absolutely.
But I don't see us with that.
It's not even that bad. You can't even fathom, not for anybody to necessarily have sympathy or empathy for this species, but you can't imagine the level of torture. Now, I come from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Born and raised there. So the coldest it's ever gotten in Chicago, and I remember this, I tell a story frequently, I was dating my queen at the time, and it was 60 below zero wind chill factor that night.
Mm.
Now, 60 below wind chill, the weatherman came on that evening and said, look, if you walk from your house to your car, whatever skin is exposed will freeze in 5 seconds.
Mm.
That's 60 below.
Wow.
We're talking about an ice age where in Chicago, 60 below zero, the wind, it's the wind and the lake effect, and the cold is coming from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
The ice age, the ice came from the bottom up. The entire planet in that geographical area, that entire continent was frozen.
Mm.
So you're living in a cave in ice.
Wow.
And it's 200 below some nights. It's 100 below on a regular day.
Wow.
Imagine procreating, having relationships, and giving birth and trying to create some form and semblance of logic and family.
Right.
Everything you learn from Africa, everything you learn from being the original people, has completely been lost in translation. The environment, you have never been in that environment before. You had to make up new things. You had to learn a new way to survive, and it caused you to become psychopathic and sociopathic in your thinking.
Wow. And we see where we're going.
We don't have a clue. We have no clue what that genetic, axiological, epigenetic fear in white people of the other is. We cannot even begin to go there.
Mm. It's a lot to consider. And I think that it's important that you have this timeline built so that we can share this with the generations that are coming in today, because a lot of times young people come in, they don't understand why they're going through what they're going through or why they're seeing what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
My nieces and nephews just came last week to spend the week with me. These are 9 and 10-year-olds, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm thinking we're just going to have fun. fun with TT Mickey for the summer, right? And do fun things that the kids want to do. And the whole drive from New Orleans to Texas, they're talking to me about racism.
Really? Wow.
This is on their minds. And then one of my nephews told me that he was called a nigger by a white girl at his school, and my heart dropped. And I realized how important the information that you have right now is to share with these kids. And as a matter of fact, they sat down and watched Out of Darkness, so we need to talk to Dr. Cobb and let him know. had to watch the movie and had text on it.
Do you know there was a point in time when poor white people were called that word?
That I didn't know.
Okay, so when they were taking over the country in a hostile takeover, there was not enough. In England, they said this was right after the plague. They're rebuilding their civilization. 25 million of them died.
Mm.
So that's another epigenetic tag of controlling the resources and saying, okay, we're supreme because we survived this. Mm-hmm. We have survived so many different extinctions, right?
Right.
So they had what was called, what we now call and refer to as poor white trash. So they had people who, white, you know, Europeans, Englishmen and women, who were so poor, they would steal food. They didn't have jobs. They were kind of like what we're going through in the inner city when our resources are taken away and we can't feed our families. You steal and you get into nefarious behavior, and so you can do what? You can survive. So they had an entire population like this.
Mm.
They didn't bathe. They had poor dental health, poor hygiene. They were the worst of the worst. The king said, hey, if you don't want to go to jail for the rest of your life, I'm going to give you a choice. You can get on this ship and go to the New World, which is America,
mm-hmm.
and you can work off your servitude by being an indentured servant or slave. You can work off your tenure. And after 7 years, 11 years, or whatever, you'll be free. But you'll be free in that country. You can't come back here.
Right.
You'll be free in America. You can't bring your white ass, your nasty white ass back here. Now, granted, back then, you know what they're saying is white people, but I'm just being a little facetious right now. So you got a shipload of nasty ass Europeans getting off of, just imagine, like, you know, 1,000 cruise ships docking and just hordes of the most deplorable European people you can think of. That's what came to America.
Mm-hmm.
To work in the tobacco fields right alongside with the other Africans who got caught up in Europe, and that there were black people, there was Africans in Europe that were also poor, and because we populated the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were here, we were equal. We were just all indentured servants and or slaves. However, there were also original Africans here who had owned land and who were very wealthy, and that was something to have to reconcile and deal with as well. But here's the rub. So these plantation owners, all of them just really, you know, hygiene, the whole nine, nasty, you know, just nasty-ass white folks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These nasty-ass white folks didn't have, there was not enough women for them to court and to be around and to marry and to have children. So they literally shipped women from England to America to procreate with the plantation owners and the elite.
Oh, wow, okay.
Well, guess what happened? These European women came over, and they saw these beautiful, statuesque African brothers
mm-hmm.
working in the field with kadoink-kadoink to their ankles, and they caught the worst case of jungle fever ever written in history.
Wow.
And so what happened is that literally these English women started marrying indentured servants and even slaves.
Wow.
Before they would procreate with the nasty-ass orange-haired guy that's running the land.
Mm.
So guess what? they had a mission to separate, to divide and conquer. So when Bacon's Rebellion happened, they had a lot of reason to create and implement a divide and conquer structure, because their women didn't want them, and they wanted access not to just their women, they wanted access to all women. So they had to create a law or a series of laws that completely crippled and negated any power from the African male.
Mm.
That was when the African male was truly taken out of the house. And we suffer from that today. You can see that.
Absolutely.
Epigenetically, archaeologically, that's what's going on. So now, you know, so it was illegal. So, of course, in terms of creating race and whatever, it was illegal. They made it illegal to mix the race, have sex with anyone else other than your own, to marry. That was illegal. You would be dead or in jail. So the sentence, they had to make it so hard that it would be protected by the military.
Mm. That I did not know.
When you go into the deeper history, it starts making sense. It's like, oh, That's why they got away. They all snap. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, this was instituted as a matter of law. And that is the beginning of white privilege. When white people were created, they were given a set of privilege. Privilege means private law.
Mm-hmm.
So white people had private law, and that was the original white privilege. And even if you were poor and didn't have money, you were white, and so you had privileges over the rest of the population that were designated non-white.
Wow.
And so now you have poor white trash. You know, you got Barbecue Becky and Peppermint Patty, and you got all these poor-ass white people who are calling the police on us. The problem is that they're poor, and they end up losing their damn jobs as a result, because they're poor. They don't have power.
Right.
People that we have to deal with and worry about are the ones that have power, that can set law and institute law and policies that affect our ability to be able to maneuver out of white privilege, white fragility, white society, into our African consciousness and into our African community. The other piece of that, of course, is that we have to know that we have an African consciousness and what that looks like.
That is, you know, something that I think that what your platform is doing right now to help educate and bring us back to a space of understanding who we were. But I you know, the level of information you've amassed from your quest of just trying to heal yourself is amazing.
I could be just all getting along. Damn, I just wanted a little something to alleviate the pain. I didn't set out to become like a damn expert on humanity on our African journey and be a part of that process, but here I am.
Here you are, because that's an amazing information. Like, you just talked us through the entire time. Like, sometimes if you don't know the history, you become confused on what you're seeing today. And that's what I noticed from my, you know, the conversation with my nieces and nephews. Like, you know, they don't understand what is happening. Why are we going through this? And to be able to give them a timeline. First and foremost, we were, long before there was slavery, we were. And then some things happened along the way with this ice age and whole nine that created all of this disturbance into the things that we're seeing that's playing out today. And
well, just on this continent alone, we're 160,000 years old. Just on this continent alone.
Wow.
That's the oldest African artifact of the African that was found, 160,000 years ago.
Wow.
So we've always been here.
Right.
We morphed into the Native Americans. The Native Americans are not the original people. They're the people left over.
Right. Right.
Now, they will be upset about that, but that's unfortunate, because when the Mongolians came in, the original Africans on this continent had relations with those Mongolians, and that's what created the red man. And so that was so in the timeline, that was when, you know, 1491, the country moved from black or African to red, because of the influx of the Mongolians, the Native Americans, the Indians that we call them derogatorily. And that's what Columbus punk ass saw when he came over here. His dumb ass is so stupid. He didn't even know it was America. So he thought it was India, which is where the term Indian came from. That's why he called him an Indian.
That's amazing information. I just wonder, you know, how we can take this information that we're learning now and begin to empower ourselves back into our rightful space and place mentally and in terms of just being able to help recalibrate the planet. Because in their quest to dominate and control everything, you have you know, all of this drilling and for oil and this and that, and we're destroying the planet. And if there's no clean air and the clean water, nobody exists anymore. We're done. So
we're in a fight for time. We're in a fight for time.
Right, we are.
Yeah, because there are a couple of things happening. As I've told you many times, I'm doing this research on what's called birth dearth.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been numerous things that have diminished their population. You know, no wars were waged until the European arrived on the planet. And during those wars, millions of them died, and
wow.
They had to population. They had to repopulate the plant, their population, their gene pool. And so here we are, where you know nature is going to find a way to correct whatever is not necessarily natural on its planet. And so you'll hear Professor Kabahiawafa Kamane saying that the European is not just a mutation, but a mutation of a mutation. Now, I had to dig deep and say, what the hell does that mean? You know, on the surface, you just want to say, yeah, okay, you know, fight whitey. Yeah, they're bad people. Okay, great. But no, wait a minute. What is a mutation? Well, the first mutation was the ice changing their phenotype and changing their genetics over a period of years by being exposed to sub-below zero temperatures and no sun. The second mutation, however, was inbreeding. They had to breed with themselves in order to keep their population going. So that was the mutation of the mutation. So now here we are in what year are we in? We're in the latter part of 2018. And in the last 40 years, there has been what's called a birth dearth. Now, what is a birth dearth? A birth dearth basically means that if a population does not have enough children to reproduce and replicate themselves, the population vanishes. It becomes extinct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what's happening to the Europeans all around the world right now.
Right.
So everywhere you go, if you look at census data and demographic data, you will see that as the elderly die off, for every one elderly person in the European society that dies, six are not born. So that means that the populations that have to go into the labor force, which their people normally would be what? Africans. Well, those Africans in those countries are Muslim. So that's so like right now in Italy, they're in France and all that. You see all of that Brexit stuff? That's all about population of Muslims being brought in to deal and be a part of the workforce, but they bring their culture. They don't assimilate into European culture.
Right.
They bring their own culture.
Right.
So now let's look at America, where there was supposed to be, this country was supposed to be a safe haven for white people. In other words, if you can come here and you can be labeled white and you accept the laws and the rules and the privilege of being white, you can make it in America.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So we pushed the African Americans out of the way, the Negroes, the coloreds, the niggers, all of what names you want to call us. We pushed those at the bottom. The Mexicans are at the bottom. They don't have any power. The Asians have no power. This is a white land. So if you fail at being successful in America, where you were, if you were not born white, you came to America under the privilege of white. If you fail, it means you failed as a human because you had everything going for you. You had the laws in place for you to succeed. So your failure, you try to blame on the other, but the other had nothing to do with it. Black people are not the reason why you can't find a job. You are illiterate, dumb, stupid, and a failure.
That's so true.
Okay? You're just a stupid-ass white dude, okay?
Everything in your favor.
Okay? And you even had Jesus Christ, and you done failed being white and had Jesus. You just fucked up. That's what you did. So now the other part is, okay, I'm a white failure. I can't get a job. I can't feed myself. I can't feed my family. I have no talent. I have no skills. I know I'm going to get strung out on meth and opioids. So that's where the next piece comes in. So the young folks, so we know about the old folk dying off, but now the young folks who are being born, that are supposed to come and replace the elderly, are killing themselves either by direct suicide or by accidental overdose.
Wow.
And it's pandemic. So when you see, this is why the book White Fragility by Dr. Robin DiAngelo is the number one book in the world right now, or at least in this country, called White Fragility, New York Times bestseller, is because whites are for the first time feeling, that not that they haven't before, but they have never felt this fragile in their lives.
Wow. That's
ever
deep.
Ever in time in history, because all the law, hey, black people, you can bounce a ball, entertain me in sports, sing to me and play piano, do comedy for me, make me laugh, make me feel comfortable, and make me smile so I know that you are a safe Negro.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you decide at some point to run for president, oh, shit, wait a minute, we got black family in a White House?
Right.
Oh, hell to the no. Something's happened. What the hell has happened to my white utopia? Are you out of your damn mind? They got negatives. They got negatives in the White House? Oh, no. The country is coming to a goddamn end. The world is coming to an end. We got to stop this. So what do? We say, okay, well, he was in for 4 years, but goddamn it, he's not going to get – what? He's in another term? Oh, shit. Oh, we've got to get together. Come on over here, Jethro. We got to get together. We got something going on here. These Negroes are taking over. Of course, we won't call them Negroes because we're on the talk show, because we'd really call them Negroes, but we're going to say Negroes anyway. They got to get together. We got to save ourselves. We got to save the white people. We got to stick together, man, because we're illiterate. We are uneducated, and we are white, and we are the most dangerous, fragile people in the world. There is nothing more dangerous than an uneducated, illiterate, and broke white person.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right, which I heard in the town hall meeting last night.
That's right.
Ooh, that was scary.
And you got them coming and going. So the population is diminishing. It's not replenishing itself. And the younger population is killing themselves off. So black people, we have to know more than just our ancient black history. We have some that can recite, you know, the Metunetcher, and we got that. That's great. And, you know, we know about Baba Bam Boom Boom, but Baba Bam Boom Boom ain't going to save your ass right now. You got to learn some American history and how to create civilization again. That's what we have to learn how to do.
Right. So you let me enter on their civilization
that everything has been stripped away from us that was naturally that we naturally had. We had water, we had air, we had shelter. We didn't have to pay for any of those things. We had food.
Right.
Now everything is outside of us, and so now we have to learn how to take that back and to run it and to run civilization. That's where we're at right now as a people. Because they're dying off, and the fact that they're dying off, they don't know why they're dying off. They're going to blame us for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you saw your young sister, Nia Wilson, who just died from a white supremacist who killed her on the bus just for being black, because he was so fragile and so broke, so uneducated, so stupid, so much of a nothing, that he's blaming a beautiful black sister who's just on the bus minding her business on her way home.
Wow. Very painful.
Yeah.
It's very painful. because you have done the type of work that you have done to get all of, to gather this information, what are your hopes for what we need to do in this time frame? And then my next question would be, and what would you hope this information do for the generations to come?
Well, thank you for asking that question. And I have asked that question many times myself. And it wasn't until I had a conversation with Dr. Edwin Nichols in my first interview with him, actually. I think it was around January 2016, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
It's elite. It will only take one generation epigenetically to turn this whole thing around.
Wow.
That changed my life.
Mm.
That changed my life because then I knew what my mission was. I always tell the family, when you, your job is to find out what your purpose in life is.
Mm-hmm.
Once you find your purpose, the gods, the ancestors, God will give you your assignment.
Right.
My assignment is to educate as many of my family as possible, my young family,
mm-hmm.
my children, my babies. Not only what has happened to them, what is happening to them, and what will happen, as you fortify your mind, as you get the knowledge, get the information, get the education, and not just a formal education, but an education on what has happened to us, why it happened, how it happened, and what you can do about it now that you have the how and the why.
Mm-hmm.
You have one life cycle to be able to turn this whole country around. As this country now is turning brown and black, from now, 2018 to 2050 will be unrecognizable.
Wow.
Our babies, those 10-year-olds and 9-year-olds that were talking to TT Nikki,
mm-hmm.
they're the ones that will change this entire, not just country, but they're going to change the entire world.
Yes.
They have to have the knowledge. And so that's why I pushed you to get a radio show. That's why I pushed to do my show. We have to get information into the hands of our young people by any means necessary. We have to use a Malcolm X approach to going after our children, and we have to stalk them, and we have to say, hey, watch this on your phone. Listen to this on your iPod. This is what you need to be listening to right now. We don't need to march. We don't need to protest. We need to get the education. We need to listen, and we need to hear.
Right.
And we need to learn. That's what we need to do.
Wow. This was deep. Believe me, went in. It was so much powerful information, and I know we could be here all day, which is why we have to do this again.
Because
we're not even done. We have more stuff to come. I'm sure as we continue to go forward, you have more shows with more information, with more professionals that are coming on, that you're bringing more and more people on to your Comedic Wisdom School. So there's so much more information that is being amassed that we have to be able to share with the public. And I'm just so grateful that I know you, and I'm so grateful that you are taking the time to help us, educate us, inform us. Through your own pain, you have birth healing for those of us around the world. So I'm just grateful for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm grateful for you as well, Nicola. You have gone through, if not an equal, perhaps even a larger level of pain, and you're doing the exact same thing as I did, and you are helping and healing your people. You're healing the world by sharing a wealth of information on how to heal and how to recover from our epigenetic pain and dyspareunia. And I just admire you greatly. You are one of the strongest queens I know. And one of the things that we have to know is that this is not going to be a male-led war in consciousness. This will be female-driven. The Black queen is going to, the African queen the Wakandian queen,
right,
is literally going to be ushering in this new level of consciousness and a new level of strength that we have not had because we've been stripped of our power, and we have to relearn how to be men again.
Yes. Wow. Thank you so much, Philippe. For those who have not listened to your shows on YouTube and abroad, would you like to leave all of your information?
ThePMShow.tv, ThePMShow.tv. You can capture everything there and just put the name in or Philippe Matthews Show on YouTube or in Google or whatever. All of that stuff will pop up.
Okay. Thank you so much. Now, for those who have not heard my videos on YouTube, you can catch me on Courage to Change. And you can type in my name, Nicola Hurst, Courage to Change, on YouTube. And I walk you through healing modalities for recovery, as well as you can go to nhalchemy.com. There's a link in that website that actually leads you to the Comedic Wisdom School for Philippe. So if you ever want to sign up to get more information and insight for the school, there's a link in that website. So nhalchemy, ALCHEMY.com. So you can find me there. And I just want to say thank you once again, Philippe. You are such love and light. You are a beautiful soul, and I'm so grateful that you took this time to do my show, my first show.
Absolutely. There's no place in the world I'd rather be right now.
Thank you. I'm sorry?
I say I appreciate you, my sister.
Thank you. So until next time, family, I just want to wish you peace, love, and high vibrations. Talk to you next time. Bless you.
Okay.